Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We are about to hear argument in the case of Barnett against Raoul. Ms. Murphy.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Deputy Solicitor General Sarah Hunger on behalf of the appellants. In Bevis, this court concluded that plaintiffs were not likely to succeed on the merits of their Second Amendment claims, challenging the state's restrictions on assault weapons and large capacity magazines based on the evidence in that record. On remand before the district court, the parties presented additional evidence, but none of that evidence changes this court's preliminary conclusion. The district court's decision to the contrary was error, and it should be vacated and reversed. To start, the evidence in the record confirms that the restricted items are more like military-grade weapons than firearms that are used for individual self-defense. It remains undisputed that when fired in semi-automatic mode, the M16 and the AR-15 have identical capabilities and lethality. It's also undisputed that the military typically uses M16s in that semi-automatic mode.
What about Ms. Hunger, the argument that one of the state's expert witnesses talked about the fact that they would never send semi-automatic firearms into battle? Yet automatic capability is important.
The state does not dispute that the automatic capabilities can be used in certain circumstances, such as suppression fire, and also that that can have a utility. It's also important to note, however, that all of the experts, including the plaintiff's experts, agreed that that was rarely used, that automatic capability. And part of the reason is because when troops are sent into battle, they typically also have an individual that has an M249, which provides suppression fire. And so typically, individuals that have the M16 are using semi-automatic fire, and it's only in kind of unexpected or rare circumstances that they would use that for automatic fire, but that is a capability that is used. Yes.
Isn't it an uphill battle, though, for the state? Here we've got a clearly erroneous standard of review. We've got a district court who held a four-day trial, 16 to 18 expert witnesses, 250 exhibits. I think this is the first time we've had a full trial record. Any federal appellate court in the country has had a full trial record. Isn't that an uphill battle for the state to overcome those findings, like M16 is different than AR-15?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. The first is because de novo review applies here, and I'm happy to get into that. But also, I'm happy to address any statement under a clearly erroneous standard that the district court made and show why we believe that we can overcome it, either because it's actually undisputed, or because it's disputed but not dispositive, or because it was clearly erroneous. But that being said, de novo review—
But your de novo review wouldn't apply to the district court's findings of fact, which I know you have argued the district court didn't make them, and I think maybe you should move on to the fact that there were some made, not in your traditional, here's your findings of fact and conclusions of law, but the law doesn't require a particular format. So the district court did make specific findings differentiating AR-15s from M16s and M4s, and how do you get around that?
Sure. So just quickly, Your Honor, this court has said in Schoenthal and in Rush that the standard of review is de novo for Second Amendment claims. And I understand that in Schoenthal it was a summary judgment posture, but the court did say it is de novo review both because it's summary judgment and because it's a question of law. And in other similar—
But de novo review can apply to the legal question, but there are particular facts here which we sent the district court back to explore and develop, and those factual findings, the clearly erroneous still applies to.
Well, this court remanded to develop additional evidence. It did not remand for factual findings and did not instruct the court to have a trial. Our view is that this could have been resolved on summary judgment. As Your Honor has pointed out, that's how most courts have addressed this across the country.
Those are preliminary injunction cases, though. This is a merits case, and it's gone down once, it's come back. I'm wondering if we'd hear the same argument from the state if the finding had been M16s and AR-15s are the same. I think you'd be relying upon the clear error, wouldn't you?
No, I mean, before the district court, you know, we have been consistent that we believe these are legislative facts. They are questions of law, and the plaintiffs agreed before the district court. If you look at document 251 from pages 2 to 5, they're clear that these are legislative facts and not adjudicative facts.
You didn't raise that argument here until your reply brief. Have you waived that legislative facts argument?
No, we have not waived
that.
We did say that.
Thank you.
We did say that de novo review applies because it's a question of law, and also that, I suppose the district court did not make any findings of fact. I would view this as a sub-argument of that.
But the test, back to your no findings of fact, the test that this court developed in Bevis at step one required factual determinations. So the ultimate question and ultimate analysis is a legal one, but step one under our Bevis test, which is at the moment still the law of this circuit, required factual determination. So I know I don't know how you can resist that given the test that was set forth in Bevis.
I'll respond to that, and then I can move on to kind of the findings that were made by the district court and address those in turn. You know, in Bevis, the court remanded and said if there is additional factual development, it could change the outcome. It did not, unlike in other, you know, decisions that I've seen, say we are remanding for these specific findings of fact to be made so that we can answer this outstanding question. It simply invited the parties to develop the evidence, and if it did so, could change the outcome here.
Isn't there a related question? Under Federal Rules of Procedure 52B, the state could have made a motion to amend the findings of fact up to 28 days after the judgment, and I don't think that motion was made. So if the state did have trouble with those, why wasn't that type of a motion filed?
Well, again, because our view, consistent with the way that the district court set up its decision, which is legal analysis, is that this is a question of law. So I think our position is actually consistent from the district court until now. But again, you know, I'm happy to address any of the statements that were made by the district court, because I do think to the extent the clearly erroneous standard or some other deferential standard applies, because I do think there is case law on this adjudicative versus legislative facts where it says that the clearly erroneous standard might not apply, but it might not be subject to de novo review. But
there is case law on that, I'm sorry, I think I may have cut you off and prevented you from answering the why question. Why haven't you waived or forfeited that legislative fact argument by not raising it until your reply brief?
We did not use those words in the opening brief, but I think we were responding to a point made in the response brief as to why de novo review did not apply. So that is my view on that. But going to, you know, the statements that the district court made, you know, I think one that we could start with is whether or not these weapons are useful for self-defense purposes. I think that was a big component of the district court's decision. And if you look at the reasoning, the district court says the reason why these are useful for self-defense is because, quote, more rounds equals a higher chance of survival. And that is something you see in the plaintiff's brief here and also in their expert reports. Watt and Little both kind of make this statement. It's their view that more rounds equals a higher chance of survival for self-defense. But they don't have any evidence actually supporting that opinion. The defendants do. If you look at the Lucy Allen report at 185-8, she did an extensive analysis looking at the NRA Armed Citizen database and also news sources, as well as a couple of other databases, and found that in assessing the empirical evidence, on average, in self-defense encounters, individuals shot 2.2 shots. And when she looked across hundreds, there's only 2 incidents of more than 10 rounds. That's 0.3%. So in our view, it would be clearly erroneous to credit an unsupported statement by an expert saying more rounds is better for self-defense when there is an empirical assessment in the record showing that only 2.2 rounds are necessary. So that is an example, I think, of if we are required to meet the clearly erroneous standard, we would meet it. I also think there's evidence.
Is that just reweighing evidence?
No, it's not reweighing evidence.
If you have an expert giving expert opinions, And you do have this empirical data, but maybe the district court didn't find the study underlying the empirical data persuasive. It sounds like that's a weighing question.
That's not in the district court's opinion. You know, I think that is the purpose of Rule 52A1. If the district court said, I made a credibility determination here. I heard this. I heard this. I understand there is this evidence in the record, 2.2 shots. However, I was persuaded, you know, by this specific statement. The district court did not do that. And so we actually have no idea.
It's not a hard argument to make, though, because the opinion's over 160 pages long. I mean, it's very detailed. Mm-hmm. And itself builds upon this very large trial record, which itself builds upon hundreds of pages of findings of fact submitted by both parties. So mm-hmm. Isn't that a tough argument to make that the district court didn't cover something in such a lengthy opinion?
Well, I'm happy to respond to another statement where the district court did support that in the way that I just described. I've read the opinion several times, and there's a lot of, I think the first 100 pages are a discussion of the case law. You know, it's really pages 100 to about 120 that have the analysis there. And there are statements made like that that, again, I'm happy to point to, the district court's, the record in front of the district court, because even under a clearly erroneous standard, there is still a review of the evidence, and this court can find that a determination was clearly erroneous. Again, we don't believe that that is necessary, but we also believe that we would meet that burden. And, turning to, other statements that are made by the district court, for example, the district court says that these are useful for self-defense additionally because of the features that individuals could rely upon in self-defense scenarios. But all of those features, if you look at even the plaintiff's expert reports, rely upon the assumption that there will be rapid, sustained fire. And that is just not the case in self-defense scenarios. Again, going back to the Allen report and looking at what actually happens in self-defense scenarios. For example, Watt says, the pistol grip aids in, quote, rapid follow-up shots. The flash suppressor helps fire follow-up shots at faster rates. The forward grip helps in adverse weather conditions. These are not things that happen in self-defense scenarios. If you're looking at self-defense in the home, which is where somebody in Illinois would use an assault weapon because we have a concealed carry ban that only allows handguns and not other weapons out in kind of the public, if you're looking at a home self-defense scenario, it's close encounters, again, 2 to 3 shots. You're not looking for long range. These features are not necessary, and also they're not chosen by individuals.
Does it have to
for
be
self-defense?
Home? Do you have to look at this from a home self-defense perspective as opposed to a broader self-defense perspective?
No, but I do think that in Illinois, it would be in the home, if that makes sense, practically speaking, just because of how all of the different firearm laws work together. So Illinois does have a concealed carry regime where you can carry handguns or guns that you can conceal. And so I think just realistically, it would be a home self-defense scenario. In other states, that might not be the case. You might be able to carry these weapons out in public. But I think the context here does matter when you're looking at the type of self-defense scenario that individuals attempting to use this firearm in Illinois would use. I also think it's important that the evidence in the record shows that in the moment of needing to use a firearm for self-defense, individuals choose handguns. They do not choose rifles. Again, I'm going back to the Lucy Allen report, but it is very helpful. And she looked at the Heritage Foundation's defensive gun use database. And based on the reported data there, in 90% of self-defense situations, individuals reached for a handgun. 6% reached for a shotgun. Only 4% reached for a rifle. And so we have empirical evidence in the record showing that these weapons are not necessary for self-defense. They're not chosen by individuals for self-defense. They're not even the most useful for individuals in self-defense. And on the other side,
is the Lucy Allen report focused on Illinois, or is it broader?
It's broader.
And would your statement that you said earlier about not using AR-15s for outside of the home because of gun regulations here, would that impact the Lucy Allen report at all? So could her statistics be off if her focus was not based on Illinois and the concealed carry, etc.?
No, I don't think so. I mean, in this kind of universe, you know, to be perfectly honest, is we have just different types of data available for these things. And Lucy Allen looked for the type of data that she could get, and that's what she could find. In other states, there are state-specific databases. I'm not aware of any in Illinois. And so I think her scope was national.
When we're pointed to evidence like this, though, I'm struggling to see how this is not reweighing. I mean, we're looking at the district court's findings, and the district court is reaching these conclusions after reviewing the record and hearing all the witnesses. Isn't that what we should be pointed to versus individual items in the record?
No, Your Honor. And I also think, though, there's a question about when, you know, to the extent there is a different standard of review for facts and for law, there's also a question of, well, what's a factual finding and what's a legal determination? You know, my view would be, even if this court were to afford deference to the findings of fact, something like, is this suitable for individual self-defense is a legal question. You know, is this weapon militaristic would be a question of law. I mean, I think that what's interesting here under Beavis and under Bruin is there are kind of sub-questions before you get to the bigger question. And I do think some of those are legal questions, even if there are, at the base level, some factual determinations. But I also think, you know, there's a lot in the record that is not disputed. If you look at the militaristic side of things, all of the specifications and the features and the capabilities are not disputed, as I understand it. For example, we all agree that the semi-automatic, you know, feature of the M16 and the AR-15 are the same gun. We also agree that the select fire capability does allow for automatic fire, and there is a difference, for example, in the rate of fire. And if you look at the numbers that are in the record, the difference now is 135 rounds per minute between the M16 and the AR-15 if you're looking at automatic versus semi-automatic mode. Before this court in Beavis, using the theoretical rate of fire...
Did the district court make findings on that question?
The district court just said that there was a difference in the rate of fire, and we agree with that.
Yep. But did the district court make... You just used a particular number of rounds per minute. Did the district court make findings about the effect of the size of the magazine on the rate of fire?
No.
Even though we had identified both issues as issues that needed development in the district court?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And I do think on the militaristic side, there's a lot of undisputed facts, and there are not the same findings, as Your Honor noted here. So I think on that side, the evidence only confirms, and the district court's decision does not really counter it, that these are like militaristic weapons. And I do think the evidence and the record on the individual self-defense component is different in kind. You know, you have kind of an opinion, right? Someone states, I believe these could be useful in self-defense in these scenarios. But if you look at the expert reports, their experts don't say, and here is an example of when one of my students or somebody that I knew actually then used my training in self-defense. And we have, on the other side, evidence of real-world scenarios, what they look like, what the statistics are. So I do think that it would be clearly erroneous.
Did the state have a self-defense expert?
The state did have, well, so that's a term that's used by the plaintiff, that they had self-defense experts. We had experts that testified on the utility of self-defense. We did not characterize them as such, but we did have individuals like Yergalitis and Andrew that I believe could be characterized in that way. I mean, their self-defense experts are individuals who have businesses that teach classes where you, as a prerequisite, have to have a semi-automatic assault weapon in order to take those classes. And so I also think, looking at their opinions, it is a skewed sample set, right? They're basing their knowledge on the students that they see, where as a prerequisite, you have to show up with an AR-15 or something similar in order to take that class. And so I think that they do label those individuals as self-defense experts, but I think there are reasons not to credit that testimony, or that it would be clearly erroneous to credit that testimony over the studies that were put forth by the defendants. But again, this court may not need to reach that given all of the undisputed facts that are there. Right now, we're only talking about step one, but if you go to step two, the plaintiffs have not put in any additional evidence. Speaking of hiring experts, they did not hire a historian. And we had our historian look, Professor DeLay, and he put in additional examples and additional historical context for the tradition that was outlined in Vivas.
Is there an English or founding era statute that prohibited not just the carrying, but the possession and acquisition of an entire class of arms?
I believe there was one possession-based analog at the founding. I do know that most of them come later. Most of the possession statutes come in the 19th and 20th centuries, but as this court has held, that time period is relevant under the Bruin analysis.
Bruin tells us that we're to look to the how and the why of the law to determine its analogousness.
Yes.
That one weapon ban that you're talking about, how does that satisfy the how, or mm-hmm. how does that satisfy the why?
So it was a ban on possession of trap guns in 1771 in New Jersey. That was the example that I was thinking of. And then, let's see here, there were eight more of those bans in the 1800s and nine in the early 1900s. And then there were bans on Bowie knives all throughout the 19th century, then semi-automatic and automatic weapons.
And we're to look to the how and the why of the yes. ban. That's where there's trouble for the state on that second step, isn't there?
No, there isn't, as this court held in Bevis. I mean, I think to reach that conclusion would require reaching a different result than the one that this court reached in Bevis. And because the historical tradition is about reserving, dangerous weapons for law enforcement and military use and restricting civilian access to these especially dangerous weapons in a manner that is appropriate for the danger that they pose. And so these, weapons, trap guns, of course, that's why you would ban the possession, because you don't want a trap gun at your house. You don't want it out in public. But these knives, these clubs, these other types of smaller weapons, the danger was that somebody would have them hidden under their coat and, commit a criminal act, stab somebody. And so they didn't ban the possession, they ban the carriage of it. And that's consistent with the Second Amendment. The idea is that states and localities should not be banning things in a scope that is broader than necessary. And so our view is that this is consistent with all of these statutes. And again, the plaintiffs, all of this, was in front of this court in Bevis. And the court decided that the state had satisfied its burden.
You're arguing as if there wasn't a remand. there was a remand for us to answer some of these, have some of these questions answered, then come to us for us to perform our appellate function. And that's the record has changed as a result of that. That's what we're dealing with.
But only in our favor is what I am saying, that the plaintiffs did not put in any additional evidence. And in fact, the plaintiffs just reiterate this view that if there are enough of these in circulation, then it's in common use, and therefore it accords with the historical tradition. And on that point, they actually have less evidence than when they came here before, because
it seemed like the district court at step two, at step one, there was a lot of additional evidence put in about whether or not these weapons are arms, and the district court made specific findings that these are arms and supported that with particular findings. I know you disagree with that, but there in the opinion, there are enough findings in there different from what the Bevis 1 preliminary injunction record looked like. But it did not seem like there was that same development on step two.
Correct.
And I understand that the step two is much more of a, it's a historical analysis, not a factual determination. So there wasn't the need, but given where we came out in Bevis, I was surprised that there wasn't more done on step two.
And defendants did put in more evidence at step two. If you look at the delay report, he did explain the context of these dangerous and unusual restrictions. But, you know, to be quite honest, our experts did a very thorough job at the preliminary injunction stage. And when we asked them, we asked them to go back, said, you have more time now. Could you please look for more? And they did find a little bit more, but they said, this is the historical tradition. It's consistent with what we put forward before. And I will note the plaintiffs below did not come forward and say, oh, wait, we have discovered another historical tradition. They had the opportunity to do that. They did not even hire a historian. They did not do that. Instead, they just came back to this view, which was already rejected by this court and has been rejected by multiple circuits around the country, that if a weapon is popular, it is consistent with the historical tradition. And as I noted before, they actually have even less evidence on that because many of the surveys that they relied upon at the preliminary injunction stage turned out to be methodologically or ethically flawed, and the district court struck those from the record. And they have not tried to revive those on appeal. And so all that they have on appeal is the statement that there are 82,000 of these registered in Illinois. And so our view is that there's actually less in the record supporting the plaintiffs at the second step, and there is more in the record supporting defendants at the first step. And so even if this court were to uphold the district court's decision under some sort of deferential review at the first step, which we do not believe is appropriate, we would still prevail. We believe we have still satisfied our burden at the second step.
Since you originally argued this case, there has been additional case law that has come out. I think the first Bevis was shortly on the heels of Bruin, and we were one of the first courts to tackle the challenges of Bruin. Mm-hmm. There has been additional case law that has come out, including Rahimi.
Yes.
What is the state's position as you're here today on how we should construe dangerous and unusual? Is it dangerous and unusual, dangerous or unusual, unusually dangerous? And the courts that have addressed it are a little bit all over the place?
You know, a little bit, but I was actually reviewing the decisions for that issue a couple of days ago. And in addition to Bevis, the Lamont, the Bianchi, and the Hansen decisions have kind of centered around this particularly dangerous, especially dangerous terminology that was used by this court. So that would be, I think, four out of the five or six circuits that have addressed this. So even though they use different terminology, perhaps some's especially dangerous, some's particularly dangerous, it actually was a lot more coalesced than I perhaps expected to find when I set out to read them. But in those decisions, they have all coalesced around that. And I think that's right. I mean, there's nothing to say that it should be dangerous as kind of one standard and then unusual as a separate test, because if so, then you get into the situation which this court in Bevis rejected, where you're saying, well, what is unusual? Does it really mean that if enough of these are in circulation, we can't ban that? And in addition to being circular, you know, as the court pointed out in Bianchi, it also runs counter to Heller and Bruin, because the court is looking at use and not possession. It also is important because in Heller, you know, the court said the Second Amendment only protects weapons that are in common use. It didn't say all weapons in common use are protected. Those are two different statements, and that was pointed out by the majority decision in Bianchi. Let's see. And I think...
Does that make any sense? That a weapon must be in common use to be protected at all? One of the Supreme Court's decisions involves nunchakus, which I don't think are in common use.
That is what Bianchi said, I suppose. It did say that in Heller. It was talking about kind of an interpretation of that statement of Heller, that it should not be read to say that if it's in common use, it's automatically protected, because it made the opposite statement, whether or not that makes sense in Heller.
That goes more to the common use element rather than the dangerous and unusual, although there's some...
There's discussion, there's much discussion about the nuanced approach.
Yes.
That phrase is not used in Rahimi, correct?
It was not used in Rahimi, although in Rahimi it did talk about looking to the underlying principles as opposed to the specifics of the law.
Is the state's position that it prevails here as a result of the nuanced approach and wouldn't under a non-nuanced approach circumstance?
No, our view is that we would prevail under either. I do think, though, this is all...
What's the utility of the nuanced approach if you would apply under either?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a matter of degree, because you're looking at analogies here. I mean, obviously, if there's a circumstance where there's a historical twin, that's quite simple. And I think what the court is saying in Rahimi, and then also with this kind of more nuanced approach, is just understanding that there have been technological changes, there have been societal changes. And so when you're looking at, you know, doing this analogical reasoning, you have to take that into account and look to the principles underlying it, or the more nuanced approach. I mean, we have not gotten more clarity, of course, from the Supreme Court, but I do think that the more nuanced approach is just the Supreme Court kind of articulating that in a clear way. But I don't believe that that's inconsistent with Rahimi.
The difficulty that I have with it is there aren't changes in the technological approach, and there were still, sadly, massacres that occurred a long time ago. So I don't see the difference that would allow for any type of a refinement or additional standard that would exist in this case.
Well, I disagree with that. I think that although there were certainly mass murders, and this is also in the record, there were mass murders, but there were not mass shootings. And if you look at the act that is at issue here, it is designed to address mass shootings. And that is a new societal concern. It is not attempting to address homicides or mass murders more generally. And it does not say that it is attempting to do that, because it's not regulating other types of actions that could lead to mass murders. You know, it's not regulating bombs or other types of weapons, right? It is regulating the weapons that are used in mass shootings, and that is a change, and also the technology has changed.
I'm sorry, I'm losing you where the change happens, because there have been mass shootings, as that's defined, going back, 100 years more. It's not, if it's a technological change, I'm not sure how, for example, the AR-15 would differ from a weapon 30 years ago. If it's a mass shooting circumstance, I'm not sure. We can't be myopic in our history with regard to when these mass shootings occurred. It's not just recent. It's going back.
Well, it's much more frequent than it is happening recently. And we don't dispute that there were some mass shootings 30 years ago, but there are a lot more mass shootings that are happening now. And, as Justice Barrett indicated in her concurrence, legislatures do not lose the ability to regulate simply because they did not do it at the earliest possible moment. And that, I think, is an important concept here. Simply because there was, say, a mass shooting in the 70s or in the 80s, and Illinois did not regulate at that moment, it doesn't lose its constitutional capability to do so. And that's why you see different states doing this at different points in time, and that is fine. And, if it were anything else, then you would have states feeling the need that they needed to regulate right away, before seeing if these weapons were dangerous, before seeing if they proliferated and caused a problem. And so I think it's actually beneficial for both sides here, for the state to respond to an actual societal problem when it arises, and not to have the state be addressing hypothetical or potential problems just because it's deemed to be a use it or lose it approach.
The concern is that the level of generality gets so high that the analogical reasoning breaks down.
But I don't think that the level of generality is so high. I mean, mass shootings are a very specific type of event, and this law was enacted to prevent that type of shooting. Just like, the automatic weapons around Prohibition, you know, those proliferated. There were very specific and horrible shootings, and there was legislation enacted to, you know, restrict automatic weapons. And I just don't see how, if that is constitutional, which the Supreme Court has said it is, the state's response now could be unconstitutional. And those seem very similar to me. The Supreme Court has said that restrictions on assault weapons, or restrictions on automatic weapons, are constitutional. And that's a very similar arc to what we see today. And so I think at the second step, the how and the why is very close. This court did look at all of those analogs in Bevis, and there's no reason for this court to depart from that reasoning here. I believe I might be going into my reserve time.
One more question, Ms. Hooker, please. So the opinion here and the briefs really focus on AR-15s and large capacity magazines. And as you know, the act at issue covers a lot more than that. What are we to do with the a lot more?
Right. So other courts have looked at this as well. And if you look at, I think it's Capon and Bianchi, essentially what the court said is that if the state prevails on AR-15s, it's likely, you know, it's going to prevail on the rest of the items, especially because the plaintiff's whole case is that because these are so popular and they are in common use, they are lawful. That cannot plausibly be said about the shotguns and the pistols and the bump stocks at issue in this case, the grenade launchers.
But can we make all those determinations on this record? I guess that's what concern is, that the focus really was on AR-15s and large capacity magazines.
Our view is that the state has put in sufficient evidence. If you look at the Yergalaitis Declaration, between pages 55 to 72 are devoted to shotguns and pistols and some of the other weapons at issue here. So we believe that we have carried that burden. If this court finds that there is simply not enough in the record, it could decide the case as to AR-15s and similar rifles, make it a rifle case. And then the plaintiffs, I suppose, could come back in a different case with more of a focus on the shotguns and the pistols. If your honors have no further questions, I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Certainly, Ms. Hunger. And now, Ms. Murphy, it's actually you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Erin Murphy on behalf of the plaintiffs, and I think you know I'll be taking 35 minutes on behalf of all the plaintiffs, followed by Mr. Magg and Ms. Dillon for the government. When this case was last here, the court held that the plaintiffs, quote, have the burden of showing that the weapons addressed in the pertinent legislation are arms that ordinary people would keep at home for purposes of self-defense, not weapons that are exclusively or predominantly useful in military service, or weapons that are not possessed for lawful purposes. And it remanded for the parties to develop a better record on issues like the comparative firing rates, ammunition, kinetic energy, muzzle velocity, etc. We took those directions to heart.
I really worry about the blah, 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 et cetera, given that the district court didn't make findings on several of the things we told it it needed to.
I think the district court made more findings than you're giving the court credit for, and we put on evidence on pretty much every metric that I think this court identified in its opinion. And we put on evidence about firing rate, about kinetic energy,
about— Did the district court make findings about those things?
I think the district court did. So rate came up earlier, firing rate. I'd point you to footnote 22 of the court's opinion, where it specifically talked about why the numbers this court articulated in Bevis 1 were not accurate as compared to the evidence in the record, and pointed to the evidence, which was the state's own evidence, as well as ours, that the maximum effective firing rate of 45 to 65 rounds per minute is what's actually the maximum for a semi-automatic firearm. So I think you have to look at this opinion and appreciate, I appreciate the court didn't lay it out in the way that some might appreciate a court did, but you have findings that are coming along as the court is articulating legal principles and working to understand Bevis and what this court was looking at, that's where the court makes findings about what it is that differentiates an automatic weapon from a semi-automatic weapon, and made findings about how the actual reason, once the court heard all manner of evidence from military experts who talked about why the military cares about having automatic fire, that it's not just about rate of fire, and that what differentiates a military-grade weapon in automatic functionality capacity is it's that its machine guns would not necessarily be banned because of the rapidity with which they deliver rounds downrange, but because the average civilian operator, and the court says even military operator, cannot control the weapon when fully automatic in a way that ensures that shots are reasonably aimed. That's a determination the court made after considering evidence about how what really matters in the military capacity, you don't mind that you sacrifice some accuracy with an increase.
Let me ask you a general question about standard of review, which we've been into. Cases very much like this are pending before three other district judges in Illinois. Suppose we have two district judges in Illinois find in your favor on questions like this, and two district judges in Illinois make factual findings in the state's favor on questions like this. Is the law constitutional, unconstitutional, or constitutional only in part?
Look, the ultimate question of whether the facts satisfy the legal standard, we agree that ultimate question is no.
Look, listen to my question, counsel.
Sure.
Suppose the district court makes different findings of fact. We have to determine the legal significance of findings of fact. But suppose other district judges make different findings. What then happens?
First, you'd examine to determine whether the findings are clearly erroneous.
The whole point of saying that there is discretion to make findings is that there are some things that district judges will find that could have been found the other way, but are not reversible as clearly erroneous. You just have to take that as given.
Sure.
That's what we appellate judges face every day.
Sure.
I'm asking about the legal consequences if some district judges find in the plaintiff's favor on factual issues and some in the state's favor on the very same factual issues. What happens?
Ultimately, you're going to have to make de novo determination about whether the evidence satisfies the standard. Now, in every case—
Why? I mean, it now sounds like you're agreeing with the state that these are legislative facts about which we have to make a de novo determination.
No.
But that's not the theme you took in your brief.
I want to be clear. What I'm saying is, as in any case, when you have a question that's informed by fact findings, the ultimate question of whether the facts satisfy the legal standard is a legal question. We acknowledge that. That's always true.
No, you're just not dealing with my problem, which is that on the same record, different district judges can reach different factual conclusions, neither of which is clearly erroneous. My question is, what do we do then?
And my answer is, you answer the ultimate de novo question looking at those facts that are before you. And perhaps you're going to have a case where you say, even though these fact findings are not clearly erroneous, we ultimately conclude that they don't sustain the conclusion that this is the right answer constitutionally. But I think some of this is inherent in the fact that Bruin did say party presentation matters. And inherent in the notion that party presentation matters is that, you know, you may have a case where parties present better or worse facts to support, whether you consider them legislative facts or adjudicative facts. And I think here we have a combination of both. And you may get a different record in different cases. This court had a case recently where it said, we're not going to answer this question or really revisit any of this because you made no factual record whatsoever. I don't think that means that, you know, we lose. We made a factual record, and now you examine the factual record that we made. And if somebody comes along and makes a different factual record, you know, that can happen in all sorts of constitutional contexts, not just in the Second Amendment context. And it might be a reason that courts think again, but it doesn't mean that you should ignore the record and the findings and all of the things we put on here below that did lead the district court to reach the conclusions it did. And I'd love to talk about it. I mean, you just heard a lot from the state about the evidence the state put in. But we put in a lot of evidence, a ton of evidence. We put on all sorts of evidence. And I want to be clear, we put in a bunch of evidence, not just about AR-15s. We tried a case about all of the arms. It's the state that keeps wanting to focus only on AR-15s.
Did the district court, though, the district court's opinion really was focused on AR-15s.
I don't think so.
Large capacity magazines.
I think the court was focused on the nature of the features that had been singled out, and the types of features that have been singled out are not varying radically across the different types of arms. But the state's arguments here are arguments that really do vary radically across the different types of arms, which is why they only want to talk about AR-15s. I mean, take for instance, they talk a lot in their brief about—
But did the district court make the determination that these features that you're talking about don't vary across all of the arms?
When the court was talking about the features, it talked about the features on semi-automatic firearms and the features. It didn't say, you know, the features only on an AR-15. So I'd look in particular around pages like 113, 116 of the record, of the opinion, where the court is talking about how it sees the firearms differently. And what it explained is, from the court's perspective, after understanding all the record evidence, that really what puts something on the military side of the line is automatic fire. And that automatic fire is different because it serves a suppression need, and that's what, and that the military has. The military may need to pin troops in place, keep people from advancing as you're trying to enter a structure to clear it, where you don't know who your target is, and you don't care if you're firing as accurately, you just want to fire quickly. That's like the opposite of what Illinois is coming at here, because as the court explained, and I don't think Illinois disagrees about this, it's singling out features here because they make firearms more accurate. They make it easier for someone to stay on target. So it's singling out the very thing that puts, drives an even bigger wedge between an automatic firearm that is military grade and a semi-automatic only firearm that I don't think there's any dispute is not something that has ever been a service issue combat rifle in our military or any other military in the world. And what the district court said is once the court looked at things like rate of fire and control, that's the big differentiator, and that in the self-defense context, you just don't have that same need for suppression fire that you might in the military context, because as you know, this whole case is about showing, people want firearms in the self-defense context that are more accurate. You don't want to miss your target. You don't want to accidentally hit the very people, loved ones, property you're trying to protect. You don't want over-penetration. So that's why you don't see, you know, that is what the court understood to be the principal difference here. And that was an evidence-based determination based on testimony. And you can look, there's a bunch of cross-examination the court itself did to ask the military experts to get a better understanding of what the differentiation between these types of arms are. And that applies equally to all of these firearms. So while the court, you know, didn't kind of go down to the level necessarily always of the pistols and shotguns, it wasn't speaking specifically at the level of the AR-15s either. It was speaking across the nature of the features for all of these firearms. But I do want to make the, just articulate why some of the arguments the state is making here today really don't work.
Before you go there, I want to ask one clarification question, please.
Sure.
Is it your argument that if these weapons are in common use, that's the end? That you don't look to history and tradition? That if they're in common use, they pass step two and end of analysis, even if they're particularly useful for unlawful activity or even if there were similar bans in history and tradition?
Sure. So just to be clear, are we talking only step two now? I mean, we're taking Bevis as a given. I'm happy to talk with you about where we think common use is, but want to be sure I'm being responsive.
That's a really good question about where common use is.
I'm happy to assume for the sake of argument we're discussing our position on historical tradition. Here is our position on historical tradition. If you're there, it's not our burden. It's their burden to identify a historical tradition. We think the only tradition that has been identified is the dangerous and unusual slash common use tradition. And we don't think they've identified any other tradition. You heard them talk a bit today about the idea that there are some sort of bans on dangerous but not unusual arms. There actually are not bans even on the carry of the arms they're talking about. But you know, the thing they point to most often is Bowie knives. If you look at the laws that are restricting Bowie knives in the 1800s, almost none of them are bans on possession or even things that are restricting possession or making it harder to possess. And they're not even bans on carry.
So my question for you is just from a legal framework using Bevis, I thought you were arguing that if these weapons are in common use, that's the end of the case.
No. So
in your favor.
Yeah. We argued that the first time around. The second time around, we take Bevis at its word that we had the burden to show not only that these arms would be kept at home for purposes of self-defense, not just common use, but for self-defense, but also that they are not exclusively or predominantly useful in military service or not possessed for lawful purposes. And we put on, if you look at our findings of fact, we have whole, you know, pages upon pages articulating not just how many people own them, but first off, on that first question, why they own them. We have self-defense experts who testified that people own them for self-defense. They show up time and again in self-defense classes bringing these weapons, wanting to learn how to use them for self-defense. We had them explain why all of these features are useful for self-defense. And then going to military, we have an entire discussion about what differentiates these arms from military-grade arms, not just automatic capacity, even things like, you know, military arms have specifications to ensure that you can
sustain. And I understand that and read your submissions. I just wanted to make sure I understood what your legal argument coming to common use was. So.
Sure, yeah.
And so let's flip the script then and assume we don't have the Bevis framework. What do you believe the framework should be?
Sure. So we think the right framework is to just start simply with the question of, is this a bearable arm, which we think just really means, can you pick it up and bear it? If it is, it's covered by the plain text, and you move on to historical tradition. At that point, obviously, it's the state's burden. We think the only tradition the Supreme Court has recognized that would support, that could support banning the carrying, the possession of arms is the dangerous and unusual tradition, which we understand the court to have said in Heller is the flip side of, if it's in common use for lawful purposes, then it's essentially by definition not dangerous and unusual. And that's the only, you know, I mean, our strongest form argument is that is the test, full stop. But even if you thought there was room for another test, they'd have to come up with another test. And we don't think they have.
Indulge me a second on circularity.
Sure.
Because it's been raised a couple times. Heller teaches that weapons got to protect, got to be possessed for lawful purposes. Self-defense is that. There seem to be two ways to determine that, either counting either weapons or state bans or judges decide.
Yep.
If it's the second approach, the question, I suppose, the sub-question is, are we as judges to conclude that it's strong evidence that millions of people possess this particular type of weapon? So what I'm wondering is, what's the approach you're advocating on the circularity problem, by counting weapons, by judges deciding, or some other approach?
Sure. So I think that, you know, as I understand what the Supreme Court is saying about our historical tradition, it is one under, as between the people and the government choosing which weapons are best suited for the people's self-defense, we defer to the views of the people. Now, in some instances, that's easy to do because you can look at some things, and we would submit this case as one where it is easy to do because even by the state's experts' estimation, 14 to 18 million individuals own AR-15 style rifles, and many, many more own the magazines that are banned here. And there's simply no real dispute that they own them for the purpose of self-defense. They'll dispute whether they think they need them. But if you're just asking that, we think this is an easy case. Now, I will grant you, you know, that the circularity critique usually comes at it from the perspective of, what do we do if we have something that people have never had the chance to own, and so we don't know what they would do? And I think the right way to come at that is to look at something and say, look, is it, how similar is it to the types of things that people do own for self-defense? If it's, you know, different at the margins, like it's, you know, got a 1-inch longer barrel than firearms used to have, I think it's awfully hard to say that that's going to be something that absolutely makes it completely different, and it wouldn't be unusually dangerous. So even if it's not common right now, it's not going to be dangerous and unusual.
Is it then, is it the history approach then to wait and see?
I don't think you have to wait and see. I think, and this is what I think the district court was trying to do below, is, you know, I understood part of what this court was doing in Bevis by saying that the question is whether ordinary people would keep arms at home for self-defense, to mean that it's not just do they, because sometimes you might not know. You might not know as to machine guns. I mean, I think the very fact that people have happily lived with machine gun bans for a century tells you something about whether people actually would like to have machine guns for self-defense. But even if you don't find that kind of historical reality to be conclusive on the question, that's what the district court did, is looked and said, well, what does make a machine gun different from a semi-automatic firearm? Is it something that has a meaningful distinction for self-defense purposes? And the court said, Look, it's not just rate of fire. It's the problem is you lose accuracy along with the enhanced rate of fire. And it stands to reason, especially in a case where we're here because our clients want to be able to have arms that are more accurate.
So what's the state supposed to do? Brand new gun,
sure,
no recoil, or a laser gun, something that's coming on the market. What's the state supposed to do if it wants to regulate?
I mean, you know, I think, like, the answer most consistent with the Second Amendment is you don't jump in and try to ban things until you actually really think there's a problem with them. And if something's coming on the market that seems like it just makes firearms do what they're supposed to do better, i.e. be more accurate, easier to use, maybe a little faster, but faster in a way that doesn't sacrifice accuracy, it's pretty odd for the state to say, we want to jump in and say, no, 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 you have to stick with outmoded technology. If you have something that comes on the market that's meaningfully different, say in a way that, you know, I think when you look at the things historically that people have been happy to see banned, one commonality you see among them is an indiscriminate nature. You know, grenades, chemical weapons, the idea of handheld nuclear weapons. Like, people don't want to use stuff that's just as easy, just as likely to hurt themselves, their family, their property. And you can look at new things that come on the market and look at them through that lens and say, you know, is there a reason here? Is there something about this that makes it dangerous in a way that's really meaningfully different? Not just makes it dangerous in the way that firearms, of course, are dangerous. You know, is it making it actually less dangerous because it's making it easier for people to use, like a grip that's more comfortable, a stock that can be adjusted to match the height of the person who's using the firearm? Those are good things that ensure that people are less likely to cause collateral damage, which ought to be everybody's goal when it comes to the use of firearms in the home for self-defense or outside the home for self-defense.
Question about magazines. The Second Amendment protects those things necessary for operating an arm. In Bruin Step 1, looking at the text, is the threshold question, according to the appellees, whether 30-round magazines are necessary to operate or whether magazines generally are necessary to operate? And if it is the second, why?
I think the threshold question, and in a sense this is responsive, I mean, I think the state is making an argument that magazines are just out categorically, and we think that's absolutely wrong, that, you know, magazines are not out in the sense of simply because they're something that can be detached from the firearm, they're entitled to no protection whatsoever. A magazine is nothing like a cartridge box where you held ammunition while not using it. A magazine is an active component of a firearm that feeds the ammunition in. That's why the actual terminology in this statute is ammunition feeding device, not magazine. It's something that's feeding it in. And so we think if you're starting with the question, you know, there are some courts that have suggested or perhaps maybe even held that, like, magazines full stop are unprotected. I don't think that's a sustainable position. And it also would effectively mean that semi-automatic firearms can be banned entirely, because if you can ban magazines, you're banning semi-automatic technology. So I don't think that's a sustainable position. And I think once the magazine is an arm at the threshold, then the question about whether you can restrict the capacity of the magazine seems to me to be a question that should be answered by looking to historical tradition. And there, you know, the best case the state's going to be able to make is by pointing to a handful of laws, prohibition-era laws, that swept in some degree of semi-automatic firing capacity limits along with automatic restrictions. Those were, like, somewhere between 4 and 7 states. We can probably, you know, kind of quibble about that a bit, all repealed and replaced with auto-only laws within a matter of decades. So I just don't think there's any historical tradition that starts until the past couple of decades. I mean, there was never any ban on any type of magazine itself. There were only just a handful of restrictions in the 1920s about firearms with a certain capacity. So I think they just have a real historical tradition problem there. Once you get past the magazines themselves are something that falls within the plain text of the Second Amendment at the threshold. And there too, you know, I think
back to your common use argument, you said that there are 14 to 18 million people who own these firearms. How do we think about that? A lot of the mass shootings, especially those that have included a large number of victims, these weapons were used for illegal purposes. You said 14 to 18 million legally own them for legal purposes, self-defense, but there are also these statistics on the other side. Does that factor in with the nuanced approach or the societal concerns? What are we supposed to do with that?
I mean, the answer is I don't think what you can do with that is say that's a reason that they're wholly unprotected by the Second Amendment, because that's an argument that says, okay, we're going to focus instead
on... But that would be on the arms question.
Well, I think on either question, because, you know, I just don't think there's a tradition in this country of saying that particular weapons, because if somebody, you know, who was going to misuse them got their hands on them, they would be very dangerous. I mean, every weapon is incredibly dangerous in the hands of someone who wants to misuse it. And I would note that the state's own expert on this said that it's about 20% of mass shootings that a Illinois-defined assault weapon is used in, and less than half that an Illinois-defined large-capacity magazine is used in. So,
I thought the expert also said once you start getting into higher numbers of deaths, that those numbers go up.
So, and I think that's part of why this, you know, I don't think, with all due respect to my friend on the other side, that there's a kind of generally accepted easy way to conceptualize what is and isn't a mass shooting. There's a lot of different metrics and statistics that float around here in different studies. But I think it's all asking the wrong question, because as I understand what the Supreme Court has been saying is, look, the point of the Second Amendment is to say the people made a judgment that we'd rather protect the right of the law-abiding citizen to defend themselves, even if that means that arms may find their way into the hands of the non-law-abiding citizen. It was not lost on the framers that people could misuse firearms and other arms for horrific reasons. They may be even more horrific today and easier to cause even more horrific and massive destruction and death than it was then, but this was not a concept that was lost, and the very balance in the Second Amendment is to say that itself is not something we're going to take to override the right of the law-abiding citizen to protect themselves against the threat from the non-law-abiding citizen. And that's, I think, why when the Supreme Court examined our historical tradition in Bruin and in Heller, what it found in both cases is that the historical tradition focuses on what is in common use by the law-abiding citizen for lawful purposes like self-defense. That's what the test focuses on, not is this also the preferred weapon of criminals. Indeed, most of the argument on the other side that was made in Heller, once you got past the fight about whether there's an individual right at all, was an argument about how handguns are the weapon of choice for criminals. Handguns are the weapon of choice for all manner of crimes, are used significantly in mass shootings, are used all over, and the court didn't say you're wrong. You know, they didn't say, if you come back to us with better statistics, we might take a different view on this. They said that's not the right way to think about the question. So we're not here to suggest that we don't appreciate that there is a significant concern that is animating what the state is trying to do here, but means matter as well as ends in all manner of constitutional analysis, including the Second Amendment.
A question on the registration statute. If we end up agreeing with the state that the act is severable, and we find part of it to be unconstitutional, what are we supposed to do with the registration requirement?
Sure. So while I think we'd have an independent argument about the registration requirement, even if we did uphold the arms ban, I don't think the registration requirement can stand if the arms ban is unconstitutional under a severability analysis, because the whole point of the registration requirement is to facilitate the grandfathering exception. It just exists so that you'll have a record. The state can say, okay, I know you bought this before the ban took effect. So if the ban goes away, it's not serving its purpose. And in fact, it would be serving sort of a perverse purpose, because it's not an all-purpose registration requirement. You'd have this oddity where there's a legal requirement for people who bought these firearms before PICA took effect to register them, yet the ban that required them to do so is now gone, and people going forward don't have to register. I think the right, that seems to me a classic severability situation where the legislature, you know, one thing was there to serve the other. And so if the ban goes away, there's, you know, the legislature can decide if it wants to have an all-purpose registration requirement, we could come back and fight about the constitutionality of that. But I don't think it would make any sense for that to stand as this kind of, like, you know, but just hold over a piece that's no longer serving the purpose of what the legislature established it for. And of course, we, you know, we do have an independent challenge to that, but I think in some ways those particular pieces are very intertwined, the registration requirement and the arms ban itself. I could just, you know, just want to make a few points about a few more of the things that the state specifically
I have a question about the remedy.
Sure.
Is the district court's remedy consistent with Trump against CASA?
In the sense that...
This appears to be a universal injunction. It is runs in favor of people who are not plaintiffs. And in fact, it's so universal, it runs against people who are not named defendants.
As we said, we don't have a problem with the court fixing the defendant issue. And frankly, we don't have a problem if you wanted to clarify that the injunction itself runs as to our
no,
plaintiffs.
It's not a question of clarification. Trump against CASA was not about clarification. It was about the power of a district judge.
Sure, and perhaps I can be clearer. We don't have a problem if this court says that the district court has to narrow the scope of the injunction to our clients. Obviously, this court's decision would have effect all throughout the Seventh Circuit if it were saying the law
unless
is unconstitutional.
Unless some district judge makes a contrary finding of fact.
This court's law would be this court's law until this court's law changes. And so we are happy to live with, if it's important, if the court views the scope of the injunction as overbroad, we are happy to have relief on behalf
is
of our
clients. Is there any if? When you say if the scope of the injunction is overbroad, it sounds like you're saying there's some doubt about that under CASA.
Again, we are happy for the court to say that the scope of the relief is overbroad. We will live with an injunction that protects our plaintiffs. There are, as I'm sure the court is aware, many plaintiffs here and many groups here. And I think even an injunction covering all the plaintiffs here would cover pretty much everything that we're looking to cover, along with a decision from this court that would be saying that the law is unconstitutional, which of course has its own effect all throughout the jurisdiction. I do think that there are aspects of the court's injunction that we can live without, but we absolutely would like relief as to our plaintiffs on the things that we challenged here, including the registration requirement. Just a few other points I just want to make to be clear about some things that the state said. First, just on the historical tradition, I just want to be very clear. I started to get to this earlier, but I'm not sure I quite got it out, so we'll say it again. On the history of bowie knives, I really encourage you to take a look at those laws. You know, it's often said that there are bans on carrying bowie knives. That's really not even correct. The bans on carry as to bowie knives were concealed carry restrictions. So the laws dealing with bowie knives were generally concealed carry restrictions or things that enhance the penalty if you misuse a bowie knife in a criminal way. And that's really critical when it comes to historical tradition because Bruin specifically considered concealed carry restrictions in the context of asking whether they were sufficient to justify a ban on carrying particular arms and said that they are not. So a fortiori, a ban on concealed carry of particular types of arms cannot support a ban on possession of arms. I don't think there's any way to kind of get from A to B on that in Bruin, and I do think if you take a look at those laws, you will find that very few of the laws were actually prohibitions on possession, and the few that were, one of them is like the law that was held unconstitutional in Nunn versus Georgia. So there's just hardly any that are actually the kind of bans that could support any historical tradition that would support a possession ban. And the other thing I would just like to make the point about some of the arguments that the state is making here today, they're a real problem that they don't map onto PICA, and they also don't map onto the lines itself the state is trying to draw when it comes to the Second Amendment. Because a lot of what they focus on in their brief is muzzle velocity, kinetic energy, penetration, these ideas of what gets at lethality. Well, as our experts explain ad nauseum, what actually drives those metrics is the length of the barrel and the nature of the ammunition. But PICA doesn't regulate on that basis. In fact, the arms that it bans vary in barrel range from 8 inches to like 24 inches. It covers rifles, it covers shotguns, it covers some types of pistols, and they use all different types of ammunition. And so the state is offering this metric, but then it only wants to focus on how it impacts AR-15s equipped with a particular type of ammunition, and those arguments don't even map on at all to how a PICA banned pistol that has completely different ammunition, let alone a PICA banned shotgun, is going to compare when it comes to velocity and penetration and all of these metrics. The flip side problem they have is an AR-15 equipped with a particular type of ammunition is actually going to be the same as a bolt-action rifle that has that same type of ammunition when it comes to velocity and penetration. Again, because what matters is the barrel and the ammunition. And so they have an argument that's too narrow as to their own law, but too broad as to the things that they want to say, no, 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 we wouldn't touch that, it's protected. Same problem with their rate of fire argument. What a semi-automatic fire rifle actually compares most with when it comes to rate of fire is a semi-automatic pistol. But they don't wanna, you know, they're here saying that they think that the semi-automatic handgun is the quintessential weapon and that they shouldn't be able to ban it. Yet they have this argument about both, you know, magazines being accoutrements and then rate of fire, that if you took it to its logical conclusion, would let them ban those as well. So I think there's real problems with their arguments, not, you know, they just want to have this sort of AR-15 specific argument that isn't even accurate as to AR-15, since it doesn't take into account the critical factor of what kind of ammunition.
I'd like to go back a bit into history. Obviously, we can't do much history in an oral argument. The Supreme Court said in Heller that the ban on automatic weapons, machine guns from the 30s, was constitutional. Let's put to one side the fact that that's dicta. Should it matter what kind of statute states were enacting in the 30s to separate machine guns from other things? I raise that question because the statute in DC defined as a machine gun anything fed from a clip, that is, from a magazine.
Yep.
And so did the statute in California. So if you're looking at what happens in the 30s, what significance should we give that in the constitutional analysis?
Sure. I think it's fine to look at what was happening across the states as well for purposes of examining. I mean, we can have a debate about, you know, whether that's obviously that's later in history, but looking at that to see how it aligns with historical tradition. So kind of set that timing debate aside for a moment. We invite you to look at those laws because what you will find is that actually most of them, including California, had distinctions that specifically said something different about automatic versus semi-automatic fire. They defined it much the way the law that the court just considered it to be.
The language in California was all firearms which are automatically fed after each discharge from or by means of clips, drums, barrels, etc. They defined automatic as using the gas discharge to load another bullet,
right?
Not avoiding a separate pull of the trigger.
And my recollection, and I'm sorry, it's been maybe an argument since I focused on California, is there's actually a second statute that comes into play and shows when you look at them together, they didn't actually reach a true semi-automatic firearm. And that ends up being the case as to most of these laws. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 8 of the roughly 27 state laws that were passed that might be read to reach automatic, not just semi-automatic. And those laws, they repealed or clarified them later to make clear we didn't mean to reach them. So I think if you look at that and ask that question, you will find that the tradition actually was focused on automatic and distinguishing automatic from semi-automatic. It was the small minority of jurisdictions that didn't appreciate a distinction about that at first, and they came to appreciate it very quickly and changed their laws. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have a problem with you looking back at that because we think that history ends up favoring us tremendously.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. May.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Thomas Magg. I represent the Langley plaintiffs. I think I'll start with probably what the panel just left off with, and that was some of the regulation of the machine guns in the 30s. It's important to note that, at least at the federal level, there was no machine gun ban in the 30s. It was a tax and registration scheme still on the books. As long as you're willing to pay the $200, you buy all the machine guns you wanted. And that statute's still on the books. There's since been other statutes enacted at the federal level of the 1980s that prevent new machine guns, but from the 1930s, it's a tax registration scheme. And I know this court has written hundreds of opinions on discussing how it's just a tax statute. The California statute I'm not personally familiar with, but most of the machine gun state level regulations of machine guns of that time were the Uniform Machine Gun Act, which was a uniform act, which again, is simply a registration scheme, not a total ban. I think Illinois' present machine gun ban was enacted in 1982, at least in its present form, and was much less restrictive prior to that than it is today. But, so there really isn't a, even in the 1930s, it was the time period machine guns, a strong historical history of banning, quote, machine guns, at least not in this country. But what was discussed earlier in the debate, some of the questions back and forth, was questions whether there were historical bans on types of firearms, and a trap gun was brought up. And I think trap, to a lot of people in the shooting sports today, probably refers to shooting clay birds. Well, that's not what they banned. A trap gun is a booby trap. It's something designed to be set in an unoccupied structure to kill burglars and trespassers. Well, I mean, human lives are far more valuable than property, and so many states probably justifiably banned the setting of trap guns, spring guns, booby traps, as they should have. And in the course, I mean, there is no legitimate function, no self-defense function, no military function, no sporting function for a booby trap. So, I mean, that's what that had to do with. What is protected is, I think, fair to say, not just what is in common use today, because there has been some discussion about whether that's circular, but whether it is the type of arm that historically has been used in what in the, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but it was cited in Heller, the Amietta case of useful in civilized warfare, which I'm not sure there is a such thing as civilized warfare. But what that gets to is what would be typically used for armed confrontation at the time. And to that end, the AR-15 fits perfectly square into being in common use today, a lineal descendant of what was used by our colonists, our revolutionary soldiers at the time, and has been historically held throughout the time since then. In fact, in many ways, the predecessor of the M1 carbine, or the AR-15, would be the M1 carbine, which the government itself sold 250,000 of surplus to the American people in the 1960s mail order. And so I would ask that Your Honor simply take into account that there has not been a historical tradition of banning firearms based on the types of firearms, unless they are legitimately dangerous and unusual, like a booby trap gun, and that Judge McGlynn's injunction be affirmed. And like my prior counsel, if you narrow it to simply my clients in this case, we don't object to that. They're the ones who filed suit. They should get the benefit of the suit. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Magg. Ms. Dillon.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Harmeet Dillon for the United States as amicus in support of plaintiffs' appellees and supporting affirmance of the District Court's opinion. The United States has a strong interest in ensuring that the Second Amendment is not relegated to a second-class right and that all the law-abiding citizens of this circuit remain able to enjoy the full exercise of their Second Amendment rights as binding Supreme Court precedent requires. The law at issue, a so-called assault weapons ban...
Let me ask you about the standard of review again. Suppose the district court had found every contested issue of fact in favor of the state. Would that affect your view of the statute's constitutionality?
It would not, Your Honor.
So you don't think the facts matter?
The facts would
right?
matter.
What matters to me is that we know we have four essentially identical cases pending before district judges in this circuit. And one thing that worries me is what happens if they don't agree with each other. But you suggest that that's not going to matter.
If I may, Your Honor, I did not get the chance to complete my argument, which is that we believe the standard at this court's level was inaccurate. We do not support the militaristic formulation. And so the district court went to some great lengths to harmonize Heller and Bruin with this court's opinion. But it's the position of the United States that the Bevis standard is at odds with the Supreme Court standard. And so had there been some different factual findings under the rule set by this court, it wouldn't affect my opinion as to the constitutionality of the statute. Mm-hmm. But facts, of course, do matter, and it is, of course, challenging. The court will then have to, I think I would agree with Ms. Murphy's answer to the question that you posed earlier, Judge Easterbrook, as to...
No, your position is essentially the position taken by Justice Thomas. I entirely respect that. But much of the fight here is about findings made by this district judge and what we do with them.
Yes, sir. So I agree with Ms. Murphy on that point, which is the court's challenge at that point would have to be to look at the factual findings of the different courts, and perhaps what you would do is case by case limit your determination to each of the parties in each of those respective cases.
Yeah, I just find it difficult to believe that the same statute could be constitutional in Northern Illinois, but not in Southern Illinois, or in Illinois, but not Iowa. You get the problem.
I do understand the problem, and it is a challenge, and it is a challenge courts of appeals have to face, and harmonizing disparate factual findings is always a challenge, and ultimately courts of appeals will have to do that and resolve that. In this particular case...
And is it your position that it's because Bevis requires these factual findings, whereas the test that you would propose does not?
No, Your Honor. The factual findings would have to be made in any case. And so I don't mean to imply that one could reach a conclusion on the constitutionality without engaging the analysis as to whether this particular law meets the two-part analysis of both having met the historical tradition of dangerous and unusual. We accept that standard. But the question of what is an arm in the first part of the test is affected by this court's ruling in Bevis. And I think that is where we would disagree at the United States level, because I think the trend in the Supreme Court is very clear, as Judge Easterbrook indicated. It is, the clues are there that the Supreme Court in just the justices who have addressed this issue, particularly Justice Thomas in his dissent from Cert and Snope, has indicated that with 41 states accepting AR-15s as arms that are legal for Americans to possess for legitimate purposes, they are presumptively legal. And then the legislature has to come up with the justification under the historical dangerous and unusual test. And I think the district court in this case did a good job harmonizing Bevis with Heller and Bruin and reaching its own determination of historical and dangerous. We accept those determinations for purposes of this appeal.
And even the Second Circuit in Lamont and the Sixth Circuit in Bridges, they also didn't agree with the Bevis step one, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. So the United States' position is that AR-15s and similar weapons are clearly arms that are protected by the Second Amendment. They are not militaristic. The militaristic analysis is not even a correct rule to apply. It is not found in Supreme Court precedent. It is not appropriate historically, and it is not appropriate in the context of today. And so for these reasons, we believe that it's the incorrect test to apply. I'm happy to answer any questions that the court may have.
Thank you. It looks like there are none.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Dillon. Ms. Hunger, anything further?
Just a few points, Your Honor. I'd like to start with the notion that there's been a lot of, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, discussion here today about the first step of the test, but still, upon hearing Appellee's arguments, there is no meaningful difference in the record or the arguments on the second step of Bevis. And not only would that mean, if this court were to reach the opposite conclusion, it would have to contradict and, I suppose, overrule Bevis, and it would also create a circuit split. I mean, most of the other decisions around the country have rested on step two. They are consistent with what Bevis held. So this court would not only be looking at the same evidence, virtually the same evidence, that it already looked at. And I would note in Viramontes, when the same evidence was presented to this court, the court declined to overrule Bevis. And especially as to the second step, there is just no reason to take a different approach here than in Viramontes.
Viramontes is far different, though. Viramontes, it was a question of development of the record and what could come in, what did come in. And it was the Viramontes case was specific to its own procedural history, much more than substantive, correct?
Well, I think in the sense of procedural history, there are some kind of superficial differences. But what I am saying is if you look at the fact that the record is essentially the same as it was in Bevis, substantively, that makes it very similar to Viramontes, even if it got to that point in a different way. And it would also create a circuit split. This would be the first court across the country to reach that determination on step two. I would also like to take a minute to talk about the standard of review. As Your Honor noted, this problem of one district court versus another, there is a discussion of that in Moore v. Madigan, which is a Second Amendment case, discussing why the court was looking at legislative facts as opposed to adjudicative facts. I also spent some time just looking at this issue in other kind of questions of law that this court has addressed in other contexts that have specific facts. The Dormant Commerce Clause comes up a little bit in the same way. In the Dean Foods case, for example, there was a question about what happened extraterritorially, which is a question of fact, and this court said that's reviewed de novo because this is a question of law. Finally, something that was raised in Ms. Murphy's presentation that I would like to respond to quickly is about the features. This is prominent in their brief and also came up an argument, so I'd like to say a quick note about it. The plaintiffs make much of the fact that here in the Bruin standard, we are looking at features in comparing the M16 and the AR-15 that are not present in the statute. That's because those are two different exercises. The question for the legislature is how do you write a statute that restricts a certain type of weapon and that is identifiable for people to do so? What we are looking at here in Bruin and Bevis goes beyond that. So it's not the case that simply because under the constitutional standard, when we're looking at lethality, we're looking at rate of fire, the fact that all of that wasn't also in the statute is a problem. So I think that there's a little bit of conflating of the two different exercises there. I don't have anything further, but I'm happy to answer any additional questions. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all counsel. And the case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.